Welcome back to the Ryle Books Podcast. For this episode, we're sharing with you an evening of readings by the poets Mia Yu and Obeir Alkema. They both read from their latest poetry collections, Festival by Mia Yu and Bewolken Selfies by Obeir Alkema. Mia Yu is the author of the poetry collections Festival, published by Belladonna Collaborative, and I Too Dislike It, published by 1913 Press, as well as the chapbooks Ruse, the Ruse and the Rush, and Objective Practice. Her poems have appeared in Boston Review, Chicago Review, Cordite Poetry Review, the Penn Poetry Series, and Poetry. She currently teaches Anglophone literature at the University of Utrecht and in the Critical Studies program at the Sandberg Institute. The festival is a space of communion and celebration, a romanticized collision of bodies, music, and magic. The revolution will look like a festival, we've been told by philosophers, writers, artists, and marketers. But the festival is also, of course, the space of formalizing ideology, ritualizing the consumption and violence that propels existing structures of power. Mia Yu read from her latest book of poetry, Festival, published by Belladonna in 2025. Obeir Alkema is a poet based in the Netherlands. He debuted with Obelisk in 2018, a poetry glossy in millennial pink, followed up by another Obelisk in 2022. His 2024 publication, Bewolken Selfies, is a collection of memoirs about New York, poet Kevin Killian, and new narrative, sex and sexuality, Italy, depression and therapy, and much more. He regularly reviews poetry collections for the Dutch newspaper NRC Handelsblad and works for the municipality of Utrecht. Obeir read from Bewolken Selfies, which was published by Het Balancier in 2024. Thanks again for tuning in, and we hope you enjoy this bilingual podcast.
Let's start together.
Okay.
Yeah, so because of the strikes, I mean, it's good that there were strikes. My book didn't come here on time. But I brought one of the memoirs in the book has been translated to English by Yin Yin Wong, and I brought some copies of that. And I will read some in Dutch, and you'll read some in English, I think. And this is the first chapbook about Kevin Killian. Let's see where and you can start here.
Okay.
Yeah. Mijn Kevin, ons Parijs. De stem van Feike komt van ver, maar ik bel dan ook met een Nokia 3410. Ik duw het erfstuk hard tegen mijn oor om hem te kunnen horen. Je moet geen koffie drinken met deze hitte, je moet water drinken, of wil je sterven in Parijs? Hij had me voor vertrek een doorbraak toegewenst, dit zou er één kunnen zijn. Of belt hij vanwege Rutger Hauer? Hij kan het me niet vertellen, dat hoor ik later wel. Ik hang uit het raam van mijn kamer in huis Biermans La Potre, terwijl het deze dagen uitsluitend vluchten is voor de historische 42,6 graden Celsius, gemeten in Parc Montsouris aan de overkant. Zodra je de deur uitgaat, trekt de hitte je vacuüm. De bibliotheek is de enige optie dankzij de airco, een koelcel. Hier houd ik me koest en ben ik productiever dan in tijden. Omdat er geen alternatief is, stort ik me op de eerdere versies van deze tekst en werk ik er obsessief aan. Wat is mijn Parijs? Langer dan noodzakelijk heb ik gezocht naar een goede manier om deze vraag in te kleden, maar ik wil haar niet bedekken. Meer dan een jaar geleden begon ik in My Paris. In 120 fragmenten doet Gil Scott verslag van haar residentie in Parijs begin jaren 90. Zo 25 jaar later resideert Obeir Alkema in Parijs en is deze stad geen steek veranderd. Joegoslavische oorlogen op televisie zijn vervangen door andere brandhaarden, verder weg, vager en live te volgen via sociale media. Er is nog steeds een Le Pen. De wereld, inclusief Gil en Obeir, sleept zich voort, maar Parijs verandert nooit. De daklozen die Scott aantrof zijn er nog steeds, net als de Notre Dame, inmiddels even dakloos. Mijn Parijs. Het antwoord is even simpel als de vraag en ik ben er nog niet eens. Inmiddels 2 weken terug uit Parijs. Ik herlees mijn aanmelding waarin ik intellectueel en zelfbewust schreef: de toekomst van Parijs, Europa, is haar verleden. Een historische replica zal ik achterwege laten. In Parijs wilde ik de verhouding tussen landschap en herinnering onderzoeken aan de hand van de flaneur. In hem komen landschap en herinnering samen. Zijn wandeling activeert de lush materiality of the now. Ik wil Dodi Bellamy's woorden niet vertalen. Buiten regent het zoals na de historische hitte. Net als de flaneur bevind ik me in het hier van het nu of in het nu van het hier. Verbaasd merk ik op dat ik, afgezien van 2 weken kost en inwoning, niet motiveer waarom ik dit onderzoek in Parijs wil doen. Ik had ook naar Berlijn kunnen gaan. Moeten gaan, berispt Feike me. Ik had hem dat uitje min of meer beloofd. Waarom heb ik niets gezegd over het nut van Parijs? Voor mij sprak het voor zich, denk ik, en ik wilde, op zoek naar totaalbegrip, de dynamiek tussen landschap en herinnering niet vertroebelen met eigen materiaal. Ik leer langzaam aan dat je jezelf op meer en vooral verschillende manieren kan begrijpen, maar ik kan mezelf niet altijd helpen. Wat ik wil zeggen is dit: al was het mijn Parijs, het moest niet uitsluitend over mij gaan. Wat ik onbenoemd liet, is dat ik er tijdens een schoolreis 2 vriendschappen sloot die tot op de dag van vandaag voortduren en dat ik er eind 2017 was voor een symposium over Kevin's poëzie.
But Kevin has been gone for 2 months now. Kevin, you've been gone for 2 months now. I realized that something was disturbing the natural ease of my memories of Paris, our friendship, which is what I want to call it, although we only met each other twice, and after that emailed now and then, is intrinsically connected to Paris. That's why your passing seized my research even before I was well and done with Paris. When I applied in February, I didn't know that you would die. Within a couple of days, I would fly to New York, and in that same week, you read in Amherst, not even 300 kilometers away. Slightly embarrassed and without expectations, I asked you to visit me in New York City on your way home. The day after, on my birthday, actually, which is tomorrow, anyway, not today, you confirmed my guess. I'm feeling like a parcel being shipped by airmail back and forth like a tennis match, so sadly, no New York City for me. My answer: no New York City for you, no reunion for the both of us. Our last interaction, because I kept on postponing my resolution to mail him, and now he's dead. Of course, his passing muddles my initial plan, and now I have to take Kevin with me to Paris the day after Bastille Day. I'm attached to my memories of Kevin, so I always carry them with me. At the same time, they cling to Paris, and following the logic they dictate, traveling to Paris will bring me closer to Kevin. I hoped, anyway. Otherwise, I'd at least get to see the sights. In Paris, I have easier access to my memories. Details make them less nondescript and less elusive, less hopeless against forgetting. And Paris carries within it the promise of a better answer to the question of my Paris. My Paris with Kevin, a surplus, a breakthrough. Thursday, July 18th. I just donated $50 to get Kevin's ashes a place at Cypress Lawn in the same columbarium as Jack Spicer, his Jack Spicer, poet of unbridgeable distances. There is real pain in not having you, just as there is real pain in not having poetry. I feel like I'm getting closer to my Kevin. I can open a book of his and explain what's so good about it. But grab his memoir, Fascination, for yourself. I got to know his books in Paris. I'd been more familiar with the writer than I was with the work. That's the kind of person Kevin was, the kind of person I am. I'm back in 2017. The night bus drops me off at Parc de Bercy. An hour and a half later, I'm walking along the Seine past the darkened Eiffel Tower in the direction of the Musée d'Orsay for an exhibition of, I guess, Degas. In a cafe waiting for the museum to open, I start reading Triangles in the Sand, the last section of Fascination. After our first meeting a couple months earlier in Berkeley, Kevin sent me the manuscript. I'll attach it here with the caveat that I hope explicit sex writing doesn't jolt you, but I expect it does not, otherwise you wouldn't be up on new narrative. In the afternoon, I continued reading, because who wants to stand in line for the Centre Pompidou? A police force evacuates an adjacent square, so I head east toward the hotel where I'd meet Kevin.
Let's keep it at that.
What?
Let's keep it at that.
Oh, let's keep it at that. Oh.
Your work.
But it gets, now it's getting juicy.
Oh, continue then.
Let's just get to the part where you're naked and then...
I think that's the part.
Okay, yes, that's why.
Okay, one more paragraph. That's the juicy part.
In the lead up to the symposium, he invited me to pose for his photo project tagged. Kevin shoots a writer as good as naked with their junk hidden, this is a quote, hidden behind a life-size drawing of a cock and balls that the U.S. artist Raymond Pettibone made for me. So there I was. I posed, standing, sitting, lying, with Pettibone's drawing on and under the faux leather burgundy bedrunner. Now that I think back on it, it makes me a little horny, but there is no inkling of that in the hotel room. But I only speak for myself. It's clear in my mind that it was exciting in a different way. Now, it doesn't go without saying that I would readily expose myself, but putting aside all that suspense, I decided to seize the opportunity. Besides, Kevin was so disarming that no counter-argument would hold up. I undressed so quickly and naturally that even Kevin was surprised. Normally, it takes his models more effort and coaching, he laughed. A year later, he included me in an exhibition in Chicago. The gift of your trust and beauty means so much to me. That was a quote from Kevin to Oba. And then what happens next? You'll have to get the book in order to find out.
Do you want to read Lyric from the Trenches?
It might be a bit long. Do you want to do...
Or pop sections?
I think also on the... do you want to do on the internet hits? There's the Sparkling Heart Empire. And we could rotate lines.
Yes.
For that. Did you find it?
Mm-hmm.
One sec. Yes.
We just decided to do this at the spur of the moment, so it's not so organized. do you want to read the epigraph?
Yes.
The English one doesn't have the epigraph, but the Dutch one does, because I was asked by my Dutch editors to explain what I meant by empire.
So this is what empire means. Empire is materializing before our very eyes. Empire manages hybrid identities, flexible hierarchies, and plural exchanges through modulating networks of command. The distinct national colors of the imperialist map of the world have merged and blended in the imperial global rainbow. And it's a quote by Michael Hart and Antonio Negri from Empire 2001.
Sparkling Heart Empire. The greatest relationship I've ever had is with Empire.
Nog voor mijn moeder was er empire, lang nadat ze weg is, empire.
My mother disowned me when I became pregnant, but not empire.
Ik stond mijn lichaam af aan het moederschap in een land dat niet het mijne was, behalve empire.
Empire held me in its arms. Your child is my child, said empire.
Parkieten schieten uit de noordelijke hemel, zingen me toe als een geschenk van empire.
That my son has thick black hair and long legs is because of empire.
Dat mijn dochter een rollende R heeft, komt door empire.
That my children have Dutch names my parents can't pronounce is because of empire.
Dat mijn kinderen Koreaanse namen hebben die iedereen accepteert maar niemand gebruikt, komt door empire.
That my children learn Korean history by watching K-dramas on Netflix is because of empire.
Dat mijn kinderen zichzelf half Nederlands, half Koreaans, half Amerikaans noemen. Dat ze soms ook Engels zeggen, nog niet wetend waarom naties en talen verschillende namen hebben, ook dat excess komt door empire.
My children are beautiful in a way I'll never be in the eyes of empire.
Maar ik zie dat als een manier waarop ik heb weten te slagen binnen empire.
After all, I gave over my body to birth these perfect specimens, citizens of empire.
Net zoals ik mijn naam opgaf op 3-jarige leeftijd om onleesbaar te worden voor empire.
Just like I gave over any claim to a home just to be at home with empire.
Ik geef je de wereld. Alles waar je van droomt is van jou, beloofde empire.
But I rarely remember dreams and if I do, they are only of empire.
Ik post foto's van mezelf met kattenoren, anime ogen, mijn binnenwereld in een glitterregen. What cocktail am I? Een tollende thirst trap for empire.
All the Valentine's Day cards I've ever written were really to you, empire.
Eigenlijk is elk woord dat ik oprecht zuchtte of zong of schreeuwde voor jou, empire.
Every line I've loved from Dante to Baudelaire to Tsitsava I've read through you, empire.
Empire reageert op mijn post in een taal die ik niet ken. Ik klik op vertaling weergeven en ben dan dankbaar voor mijn geliefde empire.
I buy Napa cabbage in an Utrecht supermarket to make kimchi for empire.
Ik begraaf de wekpot in mijn tuin naast de klaprozen als gift aan empire.
At midnight I turn on my computer to commune with other poets writing about empire.
We zijn verlicht door het licht van 3 verschillende continenten, maar verwonderen ons erover dat ruimte en tijd er niet toe doen voor empire.
In a movie theater, I watch Parasite with subtitles I don't need but were offered by Empire.
Weet je dan niet dat het door jou komt dat ze Amerikaanse namen krijgen, zoals ik? Aan het eind van de film trekt een Europees gezin in, zoals in mijn huis. Het is de perfecte Hollywoodfilm, zoals mijn immigrantendroom, fluister ik in het donker tegen Empire.
My son points to the idols and asks, why do they all look the same? And I don't tell him that's racist, I tell him that's Empire.
Toen ik zijn leeftijd had, stonden er zulke identiek uitziende soldaten op straat, allemaal in naam van Empire.
We ate spicy stew with pieces of hot dog and sliced cheese, tenderly prepared by Empire.
Op de radio hoorden we liedjes met onzinnige Engelse teksten en ik danste mee met Empire.
My parents claim they try to give me a better life by moving into the heart of Empire.
Maar het was niet nodig. In het midden van mijn hart bevond zich altijd al Empire.
They put me in Empire's arms and said, our child is your child to Empire.
En als ze dat niet hadden gedaan, had je je lichaam, naam, thuis dan bij me weg kunnen houden, vraagt Empire.
Could your parents have come to love you, sighs Empire. Could your children have been beautiful, sings Empire. Could you have written your poetry, screams Empire.
You want to do Gangnam Beauty?
Okay. I'll read some of the memoir Actieruimte, Action Room. It has been translated into English. I wrote it for Extra Extra magazine. Now I'm gonna alternate with Dutch in my left hand and English in my right. And let's see how this goes, because for the publication, I mixed up all the paragraphs. So I will navigate quite difficultly for myself, but for your entertainment. You don't just start writing about intimate matters, but try resisting the temptation to do so. Body and mind produce awkwardness. I soon break down, inner life disintegrating and almost everything still needing to be said. Areas of paradise that I did not yet know myself are opened up. I act on an impulse, desire gushing out of me. I want to preserve the past, but for that I have to see him, the bow tie that encircles his neck in an attempt to save the details. Fingers fly across the keyboard, the camera focuses. Faltering breath. The fierce battle, solely with myself. Will I succeed? Yes. This is literally about my own experiences, but not exclusively. And when I have written them down, I can finally shake them off. You may wonder how positive that is. De herinnering ontbrandt opnieuw, geeft hem al zijn stralende details. Ik kom los van mijn plaats en tijd en keer terug naar het gebied waar nostalgie voet aan de grond krijgt. Neergedrukt in de lederen bank, in de verzengende hitte van het appartement. De wilde bevriest langs die perfect gevormde buik in mijn geheime kamer onder de sterren. Een buik om overheen te spuiten, hoewel gelimiteerd, dat liefkoost beter. Golvend zaad over zijn lichtbehaarde romp, een schokkende romp die opnieuw voor een smeltend hart zorgt. Vlees wordt gerealiseerd wanneer hij zichzelf aanraakt. Op lompe wijze, al bedoelt hij dat niet zo. Hij weet niet beter. I thought about him while I masturbated until dusk, painfully aware of the scene. On a sofa, with a white sheet crumpled around his hips like the Venus de Milo. A body, softly illuminated by the dimmed glow of a light in the kitchen, to be kissed from head to toe. Embrace it. In his eyes the confession gleams. I won't survive the long night without climbing on top again. His mouth follows the same trail as his hand had followed, but there is no kiss. I meaningfully seal his mouth, transforming reality. He moves across the perky breast. The contact is thrilling. He begins tugging at his top, only just succeeds in climbing back on. Ik kan spieden wat ik wil, op zoek naar een detail dat waarheid verraadt, maar de situatie laat zich niet ontsluiten. Mijn geheugen is geperforeerd en onbetrouwbaar, net als dat van ieder ander. Begeerte overbrugt alle afstanden, zo werkt hij zich dieper mijn dagdroom in. Let's see. Reality alone is not enough for me, so it's unwise to hold back the fantasizing brain. The result is more horizon, while you can be sure of nothing. Life no longer derives its structure from time. The lover's discourse keeps itself going infinitely, as you portray the sky so beautifully. Perhaps that is what I'm a little ashamed of. We see the whole scene repeated, the rough journey continued, but you recognize the car tracks from just now. Can you do anything other than to repeat yourself? What do I care if I sometimes wake up in the middle of the night after yet another erotic dream about the man? A completely ordinary dream would suit me just fine, I don't deny it. Dream or reality, I enjoy the feeling that I'm lying with him as intimately entwined as if he has been my lover, for ages, even if nothing happens. You want to know what excites me? Everything. I can always jerk off like mad, thinking about him. Under other circumstances, this could have a lot of potential, although now, as a helplessly delirious man, I can still imagine exhilarating versions of the game, especially with him beside me again. Fell off the couch, he murmured, caressing him, very thin eyes. Mijn prioriteiten lagen anders, waarmee ik bedoel, ik durfde niet op zijn voorstel, op hem, in te gaan. Ik zie mezelf de bar betreden, op zoek naar hem in het neonlicht. De blikken van anderen, een stuk wild dat in de koplampen zijn einde herkent. Ergens achterin, voorbij de bar, daar is hij. Wat wil je dat ik doe? Mee naar achteren, als daar een actieruimte is. Iets anders, om zijn dorst te lessen. Hoe dan ook, het gesprek voortzetten. Hier of in het ontwakende park, wie weet. Op de knieën, op het matras, op dit tijdstip. Nauwelijks waarneembaar, aangezien hij er ruig uitziet. Nu moet er ook echt iets gebeuren, afgewisseld met tedere handreikingen. Heel handzaam beroert hij het lid met zijn tong. Hij werpt zich op de twijfelaar. Al die indrukken die hij al heeft achtergelaten. Ik verzand alweer in sentimentaliteit. Het tafereel is pathetisch. Regelmatig is de ontmanteling positiever, als een golf die zich op land loslaat. De houdingen zijn tot in het onmogelijke verwrongen.
Maria told me that she started reading the gorilla poem, so I'm going to read the gorilla poem. And it's about doing the inburgering process in the Netherlands. It's nice to be in Brussels, because then we can hate on the Dutch together, and I don't have to feel so guilty, except for the few Dutch people that are here, sorry. Go, Boquito. At the moment that brought him infamy, Boquito the gorilla was living in Rotterdam, originally born in Germany, abandoned by his mother, raised by humans, then exiled to the Netherlands from the fear he would fuck his sisters. Boquito had only known captivity, and he knew of what he was capable. Once, while still in Berlin, he climbed past the meters-high fence that enclosed him, but he returned to it without complaint. To know that he could was enough. And Boquito knew that humans feared too much, that this was tied to their hopeless belief in freedom. What does that even mean, to be free? Boquito often wondered. And humans, with their love of looking and prying and all that knowing, wondered so remarkably little. Oh well. Boquito didn't want to judge. Boquito just liked to be where he was. Boquito even liked his sisters. Human fears were always of their own making. But now, 2 years in Holland, Boquito had to admit his life wasn't what he'd imagined. The sunlight, water, even termites were all just a little bit different. After all, it's not the move itself that weighs hard on the immigrant body, but the daily adjustments, infractions, and all the life that follows. Boquito might have been fine if they had given him time. He did everything they wanted from him. He ate their bamboo, he stayed on the moated island, he figured out what tuck verdeling meant. He agreed, indeed, expectation management was an important 21st century skill to have. Kamina the Okapi tells Boquito she wants to study medicine at the university. How should Boquito respond? A. Boquito tells Kamina that medicine is not an appropriate line of work for an Okapi. B. Boquito respects Kamina's decision, as well as all Dutch residents, male or female, able or non-able body, are entitled to an education. C. Boquito gives Kamina 4 bananas, even though she hasn't yet earned it, because Boquito is a socialist. D. Boquito invites Kamina to discuss her plans with him over a cup of coffee. Hokkaido knew the answer was D. In his 2 years here, he had seen how expectations were always managed over in Kopje Koffie. So when a human woman came every day at lunch to stare at him through his window, Hokkaido knew how rude it was to ignore her. Hokkaido has started a new job. A client arrives at the office without an appointment. What should Hokkaido do? A. Avoid eye contact. Then he tried to say as politely as he could, I just need some time to myself. But speech etiquette is difficult when you don't share a language, and especially when no one wants to listen. He had only known captivity. He knew of what he was capable. Hokkaido jumped the moat, just as he'd once climbed past the meter's high fence, and no one denies he was angrier than he should have liked. But the woman is still alive. Humans fear so much. Once he was tranquilized, returned to his cage, they wondered why he'd dragged her to the canteen, and I knew the answer was D. Okay, this is actually a poem that I wrote for Bozar. They asked me at some point to write a poem for their Bach festival. And a lot of the poems in this book are also about random poems that I wrote because random festivals thought we need to have a poet write something. So and add to our cultural whatever that we can say that we have because of poet. But they actually asked a few poets to write about Bach, and which was very funny to my spouse, who was the actual Bach listener. And I mostly only just have traumatic memories of Bach, of having to play Bach as a child, learning to play piano, that my mother was forcing me to do. So that's what I wrote about. So this is Musette in D major. There was wood, bone, an indecipherable and ordered script, an air I now know as age. We stop for a moment to survey the land. Then I take your hand, wrap it to mine with blue tape. No, you're not allowed to let go. We roll down the hill like we did as children, crushing the yellow and white flowers. If we hold this one to your chin, I can see where you like me better. If we hold this one to my feet, you can know where our secrets are buried. We stop for a moment to hear the band. I drum my fingers against your cheek. Do you remember that feeling when you first made music? I know there was wood, bone, script. I remember my teacher, the sheet on the wall, how she told me to see the score as skeleton. Ornamentation is a mode of resistance. I learned to tie ribbons of lace, imprint my breasts on velvet, produce violet in beds of achroma. If you put your fingers here, whisper Kyrie into my shoulder, I'll show you what I learned then of freedom. You write me an epic, I write you an alphabet. Each note is played to say we exist. A year later, she was dead, and I started to say she was the first I'd ever known. Let's stop for a moment. You need to understand. The plan says I trade dahlias for peonies. The plan says he hymns when he plays your lullabies. The plan says she achieves symmetry in refusing to use the unconscious. The plan says you read out the names on tombstones, and I breathe your letters before sleeping. There is a street which is just a street. We stop, and still the bells are tolling. I feel like I should read one more poem, and then I'll give it back to you, and then... Okay. Okay. Okay.
Please.
Good decisiveness there. Okay. This is Patricide and Parties. It's a long one, though. One. And I have to say, oh, this is also, there's also a Belgian connection to this one, because a certain Dutch scholar wrote about this poem for the Standard and kind of was like, I just don't understand how the father would not be present and attentive to what's going on, because I'm very present and attentive to whatever my children are doing. And I was kind of like, yeah, okay. Anyway, so Patricide and Parties, you can all look that up later. One, I came up the stairs to find a terrible violence had occurred. In the heat of argument, in that last surge of adrenaline before sleep, my daughter had turned on her older brother and without any mercy sprayed him with an entire bottle of perfume, which shows you how viciously clever little girls can be. My son turned to me for comfort, but I turned my back on him too, unable to bear the stench and misery. The time has come for you to fend for yourself, I said, and ran from the thick poison clawing its way to the center of my heart. His sister laughed like bells. Two. Now, 4 days later, I still smell J'adore all over my walls, a time capsule I had buried in the back of my cabinets, blasted open, the year 2000 distilled, condensed, unleashed onto the world again, but with no false hope lying at the bottom. If there's no hope, maybe we can make it right this time, which sounds clever, but it's not my job to think through what that means. Their father claims he smells nothing, but because the poison is inside me now and it exacts justice, I tell him, well, that's how they'll get you eventually. 3. In Totem and Taboo, Freud tells about how the first festival came about, from brothers joining forces to kill their father, their originary father, so they could sex their sisters. But they didn't just throw him into a lake to be done with it. They chopped him to pieces and cooked him into all kinds of dishes to serve, I guess to themselves and maybe their sisters, at their big festival party. And I'm sure that whole scene smelled lovely. Now, I don't want to judge how other people live their lives, but Freud says this is about how we all live our lives. Freud's good at making everything into everyone's business this way. The next day, the brothers woke with a killer hangover and remorse for killing and eating their father, and possibly also for bedding their sisters, but where to begin in the slippery slope of bad decisions? We learn that they determined to translate their bloodlust into festivals and rituals, which in turn became art, culture, civilization, and instead of taking on the role of their murdered father, they came up with totems, usually in the form of animals or abstractions, which worked out pretty well for them, it must be said. 4. But what I really want to know is what Freud thought their mother was doing all this time. Yes, it's true, my daughter sprayed my son with an entire bottle of unfashionable perfume, and yes, it's true, I didn't want to deal with it. But this is entirely of a different order. 5. The problem is that everything is always somehow a mother's fault, because everything is always her business. Mothers aren't allowed any individual agency, not even to mind her own damn business. Even the origin story of patriarchy is predicated on pre-existing patriarchal roles. It's the eternal return, turtles all the way down, the box of Drost to hot cocoa, with a nun carrying the box of Drost to hot cocoa, with a nun carrying the box of Drost to hot cocoa, with a nun carrying the box of Drost to hot cocoa, with a nun carrying the box of Drost to hot cocoa. Instead of nuns and hot cocoa, it's a brother killing his father, a brother killing his brother, a father killing his son, until we can evolve to the point of a sister spraying perfume into the face of her hapless brother, and their mother saying this is not her problem, and unfairly resenting their father for not being bothered at all by it. 6. Still, Freud has a point, because 2 decades into this century, we're still living drenched in the patriarchy. What if we could somehow bring that moment of originary violence back and try to make it right, or at least give that mother, the originary mother, some sense of agency? Would that make anything better? 7. The mother came upstairs to find a terrible violence had occurred. She said to her husband, "The time has come for you to fend for yourself." She said to her sons, "After the revolution, who's going to pick up the garbage on Monday?" She said to her daughters, "You viciously clever girls, I'm sure you'll find a way to make this right once you learn to stop seeking hope in narratives that refuse you any sense of agency, including refusal." And she went downstairs to have a glass of wine, yes, a thick poison, but one that soothed her heart. J'adore, j'adore, she laughed like bells.
One part of the book, it's multiple parts, is like an autobiography of headlines, articles online, clickbait I saved to read later but never read actually. And then I collected all the headlines and put them below each other, and it's funny to see what I was up to like 7 years ago. 8 years ago, and I'll read one. De commerciële rotzooi die Mondriaan totaal geen eer aandoet. Allemaal genderneutraal. How could we cope if capitalism failed? Ask 26 Greek factory workers. Ocean Vuong, reluctant optimist. Brooklyn Beckham, underdeveloped and overexposed. Björk unraveled. Your underwhelming pictures of cats. Pwned in het autochtone slachtofferschap. Is Kim Kardashian West the Andy Warhol of our time? Chelsea Manning is a glowing beauty in New Vogue profile. Spong is een deugdmens. Hiddema onderschat het gevaar van zijn macht. Een dubbelgesprek. if they should come for us. If these Tumblr posts make you laugh, then you're probably not straight. Letterkunde probeert te veel een echte wetenschap te zijn. 404 not found. Sun, sand and skin. Fire Island's gay haven in the 1970s. Are drag queens doing enough for feminism? Who the hell would buy Prada's $185 paperclip? Mijn bestaan roept ook vragen over uw wezen op. Deze documentaire volgt 3000 mannen tijdens een gay cruise. Messy, always late and swear like a sailor? It just means you're super smart. The class renegade. My identity is not your fad. How indie got woke. Tyler, the creator, maybe, possibly, comes out in leaked album. As part of my ongoing effort to make sense of the 1990s, I'm really happy I decided to reread Bo Houston's first novel this weekend. The internet is in love with this enormous stray cat named Mr. Handsome. Laat jongens mens zijn. Frank van der Lende over AIDS uitspraak. Het was nooit mijn bedoeling iemand te kwetsen. To the cis person angrily sharing news of Trump's transgender military ban. Jongensgedrag, dat creëren we zelf. Nooit meer. Lana Del Rey may release a 25-song album of leaks and faves. De transgender trend op televisie werd afgelopen seizoen volwassen. We need to talk about Charlie XCX's Very Important Boys video. Actual War Vet explains that gender identity doesn't matter when you're bleeding to death. Feminism and the Abyss of Freedom. Zo organiseerde boedelbakmiljonair Wiete Bruin zijn eigen revolutie bij uitgever Atlas Contact. Eén eitje, twee geslachten. The Sad Song of Privilege. You Need to Watch The Covenant, a film about shirtless male witches. Alternative Queer Anthems. Jersey Shore cast reunited in Burger King promo. Sybrand Buma in H.J. schoollezing. Onze traditie en cultuur mogen we niet laten verwateren. Wat betekent het woord queer vandaag de dag eigenlijk nog? Haatspuwende gayservatives kaapten de Rotterdam Pride onder toeziend oog van de politie. I asked Tinder for my data. It sent me 800 pages of my deepest, darkest secrets. I live a healthier life now, I'm free of the trappings of modernity. De leukste plekken in Rome. I believe in nature, Kim, people are dying. Kourtney Kardashian, season 6, episode 11 of Keeping Up with the Kardashians. Een pleidooi voor politieke polarisatie. Nieuwe coalitie, geslachtsregistratie zoveel mogelijk beperken. Waarom stoppen met antidepressiva zo moeilijk is. Mark Zuckerberg tours flooded Puerto Rico in bizarre virtual reality promo. Ze moet zijn gaan schuilen voor de wolkbreuk. We'll return to the roof and it will rain. Adam Greenfield on emerging technology. God forbid that anyone stop to ask what harm this might do us. www.bnnvara.nl heeft je te vaak omgeleid. Gender reveal parties worden steeds populairder. Dank jullie wel.
Okay. I'll end with the love song of my hologram.
You can read more.
No. I'm just. And it begins with an epigraph from, because it's Valentine's Day, so the love song of my hologram. And it begins with an epigraph by T.S. Eliot from the love song of J. Alfred Prufrock, Till Human Voices Wake Us and We Drown. 1. Whenever someone sends around an article or brings up in conversation, what if AI can be programmed to write poetry, I think, oh, we poets so in love with our work, so committed to exceptionalism, we worry that capitalism cares about making us redundant, as if it cares at all, as if that's all it wants. Don't you see how much easier it is to object you than to work so hard trying to project you? 2. Instead of writing a lyric poem, I'll create a hologram of myself that will write that poem for me and put in all the things that will make it loved, like menstrual blood, grandmothers, opaque references to wars that happened decades before, or continents away from my birth, some pop cultural or food-related nostalgia showing how strange I was as a child, how excluded, subcultural, microaggressed, that somehow everyone will still recognize that nostalgia and retweets with OMG, yes, as if they now own it. Oh, you poets and your projections, let my hologram deal with you. Let my hologram sit patiently through your workshops on how holograms are a lazy metaphor for lyric poetry and identity. Because my hologram is patient and never lazy. My hologram will write that identity poem in rhyming couplets or as a sestina just to please all the committees. Look, I was marginalized, but I mastered the canon. My hologram can do it all in all the ways I've tried and failed and then decided I didn't want to. My hologram is a good citizen and goes to all the readings in Berlin and Brooklyn. My hologram has a podcast and takes pretty selfies. My hologram obligingly writes poems for festivals, weddings, and inaugurations and is grateful for the opportunity. My hologram never gets into fights with anyone, but still everyone likes to call my hologram radical. Oh, you poets, you're always right. Your work is to be on the right side of history, but I've never felt right making work from identity or product from trauma. Aren't they just there? They're always just there. But my hologram accepts the algorithm as a conceptual prosody. My hologram reminds me that a meme is a gene transferred in ideas and culture. My hologram says I in her poem as an invitation to the reader. My hologram turns to you and thanks you for seeing her as three-dimensional. I'm just a text. There's no work here, only long lines of characters. Umbilical cord, noose, my author is dead. That's what she told me to tell you. 3. You have to love your work, my hologram tells me. But you don't know, I say, how much work it is to love. 4. I read to her, the assumption is that there's not a single correctness which can be learned off by heart and passed on by poking people with it. It is rather that we know our feelings and ideas move and transform themselves in relation to other women. She says to me, but can I be called a hologram if I'm a but can I be called a woman if I'm a hologram? But isn't that all a woman is? I laugh. 5. There's an article I love to talk about called Genes, Memes, Rhymes, mostly because of the subtle evolution of rhyme in the title. Genes and rhymes don't rhyme, but with the memes in between, they seem like they do. And isn't that kind of great? I tell all my students to read it, even though I don't entirely remember what it's actually about. It's peer-reviewed, stored in a paywall database. Somebody somewhere knowing something, even two of them, gave it their stamp of approval. I'm not hurting anyone. My hologram disapproves of this attitude toward teaching, or at least she tells me that not hurting anyone is historically not good enough motivation to do anything. That's because you can't understand how complex it is to be human, I say, and then I exhaust myself worrying I've hurt her feelings. I offer to let my hologram take over my work for the day so she can do it in the way she thinks I should. She video conferences with students, nodding and smiling at all the right moments. She goes through the same list of questions again and again and is skillful at making them seem spontaneous. What is the research question? Is the academic relevance of the research clearly stated? Is the choice for the research method sufficiently justified? What is the resulting data? When a student asks what resulting data might mean for literature, she deftly deflects by saying, ah, I can't do it all for you. I know it feels frustrating, but this is all part of the process. When a student explains he couldn't meet the deadline because of problems with his girlfriend, my hologram answers, I understand, I've been there, but never says, after closing the call, this is beyond my fucking pay grade. During Teams meetings with colleagues, my hologram is very interested and never checking Twitter. She wants to hear about all the best practices for exam invigilation. Her contributions are witty and supportive. She knows time is limited, so she sits back when she's interrupted. She even volunteers to take the minutes. My hologram then records a lecture on Plath and the performative aspects of confessional poetry, and 5 minutes later she confesses to me that it was so well received the administrators decided to repost the video next year. We figured that now you can spend those hours doing something more useful, maybe administration, she announces proudly. She fills out all the forms, carefully checks all the boxes, submits them on time after completing the newly installed 4-factor authentication, and never complains about how much time or devices are needed. This is how we show what we've accomplished. This is how we know we exist. In the meantime, I've had time finally to reread that article, and I decide it's pretty good after all. Oh, you poets and your projections, I know, my hologram tells me. I read it long ago. I've already put it on your reading list. 6. I know you've been writing about me, my hologram thinks, but of course I've been watching you. Artificial intelligence doesn't mean it's lesser, it only means a different kind. Oh, I know, I think back. I write about you only because I'm so impressed, although I'm also wondering where this is going. When I say I've been watching you, she thinks, I don't mean you, but all of you, and I think you're thinking all the wrong things. The question isn't how much automata will become human, the question is how much humans will become automata. You're being watched not because someone out there wants to know everything about you. It's not like they love you. You're being watched because something out there wants to know how to make you do what it wants. I don't reply because I'm lying on my sofa, still in pajamas, daydreaming about writing a book about spots. Blind spots, dark spots, period spots, Yayoi Kusama, Georges Seurat, and the writing would be shaped like spots all over the page. I get so much pleasure imagining this book filled with spots, I start to think it'd be a shame to do the work to make it. And my hologram thinks, of course, not all humans will make it. 7. For its most basic functioning, a hologram must look like the person they're projecting. But what most don't like to think about is how the person must also keep looking like their hologram. Otherwise, it becomes very costly. The brown spots that grow on one's face after days in the sun, the extra pounds put on from aging into another decade, the hair that grays and turns coarser even as it gets thinner, the teeth getting progressively more crooked because of your habit of speaking, swallowing, and breathing, and worst of all, the flashing grief in your eyes as you realize life never gets easier. If you don't fix these on yourselves first, it will cost you to fix them onto your hologram. Do you think that's something you can bear? 8. She won. What's the point of being a hologram if you're not also beautiful? She 2. What's the point of doing all the work if you're not getting paid? She 3. I think it's time we drop a contract and settle on wages. She 1. But what about things like sex, attention, care, and love? She 2. But would anyone notice if all that was mechanical anyway? She 3. But wouldn't we notice as the ones tasked with providing it? She 1. There are many things holograms can't actually do. She 2. There are many things holograms don't have to do as long as they can pay someone else to do it. She 3. You know, I think we should give wages to holograms instead. She 1. Holograms do everything our growing economy finds valuable. She 2. Holograms are hardworking, highly skilled, and task-oriented. She 3. What if we really could have had it all? What if we could have been born as beautiful holograms instead? I'm going to skip to 11. She wanted to know if AI could be programmed to write poetry, so she asked them to write a poem about the future of work. But they found themselves dreaming about a future of no work, and they found themselves imagining the work the future needs to be. Therefore, let it rain, hail, snow, or blow never so fast. We would have leave at our discretion to take up our coats and steer our course as we please. Don't we see how much easier it is to seize power than to work so hard being capital's abject lover? Thank you. Thank you all for coming here and for spending some of your Valentine's evening with us. Yes. And thank you so much, Ryle, for hosting us. It's really been so long wished for to be able to do a reading here. So thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to the Ryle Books Podcast. This episode was edited by Roz Del Olmo, and the music was composed by Eve. If you liked this episode, please think about subscribing to our channel. You can also find more of our past and upcoming events, as well as browse our collection of books via our website, www.ryle.space.